This is CliffCentral.com.
Are you ready to descend into the underworld?
Yes.
And touch the slimy underbelly of South Africa's criminal networks, the most dangerous people in Johannesburg and Cape Town, and people who have links to each other, and this tangled web of untrustworthy, deceitful, thieving people that live among us.
I'm ready for all of that.
Well, you're lucky, because Mandy Wien is here, and she's here to help us through, to navigate our way through this very, very messy territory. She's written a great new book, which is called Ministry of Crime and Underworld Explored. She's here. Good morning, Mandy Wiener.
Good morning. Do I have to put my gangster voice on?
Yes.
If you have one.
You know, my buddy and I were talking about you before you arrived and
yes?
saying how you're either crazy or you're the bravest person we know. Maybe both.
I don't know. I mean, I never know what the hell to say when people say that to me. Because either it's like insanity or it's bravery. And you're never going to say, oh, I'm so brave.
I mean,
I'm a superhero.
You're from Polokwane or something. You could have a quiet life. You could have, you know, got married to a farmer or something and spent your days just, you know, looking out of the window and imagining...
What, like baking rusks?
Well, don't knock the rusks. It's an important part of our ecosystem here at the moment. But you chose instead to go and sit in coffee shops with gangsters and thieves and criminals and people who kill for a living. And my God, have you discovered some stories.
Yeah, I don't really see it as like bravery or courageous or anything. I'm just interested. I'm curious more than anything else.
And somehow
so
they
it's not
all
like I'm like, bored, like put on my superhero like outfit and go off into the underworld.
I see some of these people. I want to get out of the room. You go right up to them and start talking to them.
Because they're interesting people. And they've got like hell of a stories to tell.
Yes. So is Charles Manson interesting.
And I would totally want to sit down with him and talk to him.
Yes, you see, there's something wrong with
you. You know, what has always fascinated me is I think a lot of us hear about this caliber of people and we immediately think, I don't know how I'd be in the presence of someone like that. So when you are in the company of these people, is it normal conversation or is there like a different rapport that you have to have in the way that you speak to these guys?
I act completely normally. Yeah. Like I speak to you, I speak to them.
Yeah.
And I think the reason that they speak to me and they're willing to tell me their stories is
and open up
is because there's no judgment. Mm. So I don't sit there and give them, you know, the badass carte blanche, like interrogation, you know, where I'm like, oh, why did you kill this person? Yeah. Why have you done this? You know, it's more, how dare you? You know, it's more like a...
Deborah Patter tried this and she lost a hand.
Man. Yeah. So like I just want to hear their stories.
Hey,
I'm interested.
Speaking of losing a hand, do you hear what happened in your favorite place, Bedford View, this
morning? Yeah, I was posting yesterday.
Jesus.
I was posting photographs on
What kind of a place is
Look,
Bedford View?
To be fair, because like the Bedford Centre management already hate me because of this. So to be fair, it could have happened anywhere.
No, but
like,
it couldn't.
Well, no,
Mandy, you're wrong. Bedford View seems to be the most dodgy place in South Africa. It's where all these guys hang out. That's where you go for all these meetings with them.
Totally.
You know, all the restaurants. How can a machete be pulled out in a coffee shop?
You know,
and a guy's finger be cut off?
I'd be walking through an upmarket shopping center.
And then someone else.
Oh, I did spend half the day working out the difference between a machete and a panga.
But some other guy in the place has a gun and then someone smashes a chair over the one. I mean, what kind of the Wild East?
So, interestingly enough, there's actually been an academic study that's been done on... No, really, like a legit academic study by Mark Shaw and Simone Haysom on why Bedford View is seen as a haven for criminals. No, this is real. Like, it's real academic stuff.
Okay, what if we found out?
So, there's a few reasons. So, the one is geographic because of its location. So, it's close to a lot of major highways. It's close to the airport. It's close to Sandton. It's also close to the... Wait for it. The container depots near the M2. So, you know, if you are importing, exporting stuff or storage or whatever you're up to, it's, you know, close to that in the CBD. But then, it's also seen as aspirational.
Oh.
So, it's a lot of new money. So, if you grow up in Malvern or Primrose, you're not going to move to Sandton. You're going to move to Bedford View, which is why maybe it's a caliber of people. take myself seriously.
What music's throwing
and
you?
There's one more thing. And that also that it's got this European cafe culture.
Yes.
So
and there's a lot of kind of there's a kind of European influence there as well in terms of the people who live there. There's a lot of Greek spoken there, a lot of Portuguese, a lot of Italian, a lot of, you know, it's kind of this Mediterranean.
It's very
Mediterranean
cosmopolitan. Yeah, so it's influence. Got this whole Mediterranean, European, right. cosmopolitan vibe, which is why when the Guptas first came to South Africa, they set up shop in Bedford View. See? A lot of people don't know that.
Wow.
That
like
was
a
where
magnet.
Their first office was. And, you know, when Croatia arrived, when...
You're doing Bedford View no favours with these names.
I know. And they get very upset about it when I call it Bedford View because it affects their property prices. But the reality is, this is where a lot of the stuff happened. It's a very nice neighbourhood, though.
Sure, the first picture in your book is the view from Radovan Krech's house in Bedford View from the roof.
Yeah.
It's a
beautiful
nice
houses, lovely properties, and I actually spent a lot of time there myself. It's a really nice neighborhood, so it's got its pros and its cons, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, just today, as a welcoming gift for you, we have fresh news from people who cut each other's fingers off in Bedford View.
Yeah.
It's like, Mandy Wiener's coming. Let's give her something to talk about.
I'm going to sign books on Saturday at Bedford Centre. So bring helmets and no machetes.
This book is extraordinary. I didn't want to spend too much time talking about all the stuff that we've gone over before. I mean, your former book about Kebble, I told you how that unsettled everybody, but it's become a major, major success, and I'm sure it's still selling all over the place because that story is just unbelievable. And then your Oscar Pistorius stuff, and then this, and I mean, it feels like your world is now as the number one crime writer in South Africa.
You know, the thing about South Africa is that there's so much fodder.
Yeah.
You know, there really is a lot to write about. And the stuff is insane. So, I mean, the Kebble murder was just stranger than fiction, where you've got these three self-confessed hitmen who've been hired by this.
Are you going to make a movie of that yet?
So they've made a documentary. Right. It was very complicated with the rights. I didn't own the movie rights. I had tons of offers to make a movie. The shooters actually owned the movie rights. So I couldn't sell them. It's very odd. But this story is also insane. I mean, there's some things that happen in this story. The Hawks raid Radovan Krejcik's house, but they raid the next door neighbor's house because they get it wrong. So they take these armored vehicles and bash down the wall of the neighbor's house and then take the ladders and climb over the ladders into his property and then are running around searching for him. And then it emerges that this entire time, while the Hawks are sprayed all over his house, he's actually hiding in a secret room inside his mansion. So if you jiggle the wine rack in just the right way, it opens into this cavity. And he was hiding in there the whole freaking time.
And they didn't find him?
No.
You've been into the house?
I've been into the house. I didn't know about jiggling the wine rack at that point.
Did he tell you this?
No, he didn't. Actually, the guy, the head of the Hawks in Gauteng at the time, Shadrach Sabir, told me about it. And he was in the house looking for him. And he said afterwards the architect told them about this thing.
He had it specially put in.
I don't know if he had it specially put in or if it was there when he bought it.
View.
Yeah.
People have these in their houses in Bedford View. Isn't that amazing?
So you're really giving Bedford View a bad rap here, hey?
You did. Same me.
No, Croatia did.
This is an incredible book. You tangled together, or you untangled for us, these webs of people, this huge network of people who are involved in crime intelligence, people who are involved in... They're good guys, they're bad guys, they're guys that you can't figure out whether they are good or bad. A lot of it is exhaustive because there's so many names.
Yeah.
And there are so many people, and, you know, each sort of crime group or each gang leader or each major kingpin has his lieutenants, and you need to know who they are. Then there's the police, and you need to figure out which police are good and which police are the bad ones. And then there's the whole political aspect of this, which involves people right up the chain of command, all the way to the president, people who could pick up the phone and call the president like that. And former President Zuma was enmeshed in all of this as well.
Yeah, so what I wanted to do was tell the story of the underworld.
Yeah.
So look at the actual criminals and the organized crime syndicates. But in parallel, you can't tell that story without telling the story of what's happened to the criminal justice system over the last 10 years.
Yeah, the context of it with the NPA and
so that's why, I mean, it's quite dense. And, they, you know, we try to put in an organogram of the relationships between everyone, because I knew that that would be an issue. That thing's gone, like, viral in the underworld. Organogram.
This is the organogram, and the big names in here are Krecher, Beaker, Lifman, Modak, Viri, Munu, Tlemeza, Mdluli, and Zuma, and then Mabasa and Patlani as well.
I mean, the scary thing about that is the names that I'm not familiar with, because you don't know all the names. You know a lot of them, but then you hear others for the first time and you think, yo, this network is bigger, much bigger.
Yeah, it's all very intertwined. So you have to look at the kind of context and the backdrop of all of this. And essentially what happened was the criminal justice system was captured for political purposes over the past decade or so by people allied to Jacob Zuma. So someone like Bernie Ntlameza came in at the Hawks, and Richard Mdluli came in at Crime Intelligence, and Ajiba and Mhwebe were running the NPA. And all of that was done for political purposes, but what they managed to do was eviscerate the state agencies, and organized crime saw it as an opportunity, and they capitalized.
So the investigative capacity was stripped out, the ability for us to be able to do the investigations, to have the people who had the wherewithal, the kind of capacities.
The perfect example that I always point people to is the high-risk investigative unit at SARS, which is known as the Rogue Unit.
Yes.
And if you track the story of what happened to Krecher, the cops couldn't get him. They couldn't bring him down. Eventually, they had to capone him. And it was
get
SARS.
Him on a little...
Yeah, it was SARS that did that. So it was Johan van Lochrenberg and the Rogue Unit, who spent months. What they would do is, like, for example, they would have guys who would drive past his Money Point shop in Bedfordshire, and they would write down the number plates on the cars that were there, and then they'd go and they'd see who was there and put that into the system. If he appeared in court for some other crime, they would come to court and sit there, and there was one guy who was always, like, loitering around court, and I was sure that he was some kind of agent for the state, and I think he was obviously part of this unit, to see who was there, and they'd add him into what they called this a JVL map, named after Johan van Lochrenberg, and they started to fill in all the blanks, and eventually they had a proper picture of Krecher's business activities and his network and who his lieutenants were, and it was SARS and Johan van Lochrenberg in the Rogue Unit that eventually brought an application. They were able to completely squeeze Krecher from his finances, and after that, the police came in and arrested him. So, and now that entire unit at SARS no longer exists because of the whole Rogue Unit narrative.
Yeah, I remember when van Lochrenberg came in here and they talked about that book that they'd written, and that was the beginning of kind of where state capture was laid bare, and then after that, there were so many other things that started to come out. But before all of that, like, there's a lot in your book about what a pivotal moment the assassination of Lolly Jackson was.
Yeah.
That was also a moment where it all kind of suddenly made it into the open.
Yeah, so, I mean, you've got these different things that happen, like the Kebble murder exposed the whole relationship between Jackie Salibi and Glenn Agliotti. Cyril Bierke's murder exposed a whole lot of power struggles in Cape Town, what was going on. And Lolly Jackson's murder exposed Radovan Krecher and his relationship with somebody, allegedly, like Joey Mabasa, who was the head of crime intelligence. So it takes some kind of a catalyst, like this kind of pivotal incident like Lolly Jackson's murder, because
it's almost like shafts of light, you know, it kind of pierces the armor, and then these shafts of light come in and they illuminate the some ugly network or some clue about who and where and when and why and how, and then people start to piece it together.
Well, exactly. So after that, I mean, the 24, 48 hours after Lolly Jackson died, we first got the name of George Luca. Mm-hmm. And then this narrative came out about how this George Luca character had phoned Joey Mabasa, who was the head of crime intelligence in Gauteng, and confessed to the murder, and then fled the country, and no one knew where he was for months. And then we started to find out about this money laundering scheme that was going on between Krecher, Jackson, and Luca, where they were basically doing like a Hawala scheme, where Croatia needed money in South Africa and Jackson needed money offshore. So they were paying each other in different countries and that all went pear-shaped. And then we heard about cars, luxury cars that were being brought into the country with money stashed in the side panels of the car. So all of this started to come out at the time. And it was only because Lottie Jackson was killed that we started hearing about Croatia and who he was, and he started building more of a profile, and he was quite happy to do those interviews in front of his aquarium on Kerf Road, or in the Harbour Restaurant behind the bulletproof glass.
But a lot of these guys do like the attention.
Yeah.
So this is also a reason why you, I suppose, are good at getting to them, because you, they know if Mandy Wiener's coming to interview me, this, I'm going to be on TV or I'm going to get my name in the book. And it's kind of, there's a hierarchy. There's a hierarchy that you have to climb. If you're not well known, you can't be the boss.
So this is the thing that, that Croatia, I think, got wrong. And at least John Mayer says that in the book. He says Croatia wanted to be high profile. He wanted that whole kind of persona.
Godfather
thing. Yeah, of the Godfather thing. But you can't be an organized crime kingpin and have a high profile. It doesn't work that way because they'll come for you. So eventually what happened with Ria Piecha, when she was National Police Commissioner, on the back of the whole Marikana debacle, you know, which, you know, like the massacre was completely ended her career, literally. And she, I think, saw the Croatia case as a PR opportunity.
A way to redeem herself.
Exactly. So she threw all of her resources into it and went after him, even though a lot of people actually describe Croatia as being a fairly mid-level sized criminal in the country.
You mean
he just had really good PR.
You mean there are much more important, dangerous people who probably deal in much more money.
Definitely. So in terms of the money, the capacity of money that he was dealing with, you know, it really wasn't that big compared to some of the much bigger players. But he had a much higher media profile because he played that role.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, there's two ways to look at all the murders around him. The one is either he was very dangerous and there literally were bodies piling up around him because he was linked to 13 murders. Or he was just the obvious candidate. The media and the police linked him to the murders because of his high profile. So we'd always find a Croatia link.
Is that what he tried to say when he went to court?
Yeah. Very much so. He believes there's a conspiracy against him.
But I do think you're right. I mean, just this week we found out about a 2.5 billion rand fuel deal for SA Express, and not one drop of fuel was delivered. Now, that's a high... That's a very powerful operator, a guy who can get that out of the treasury and not deliver a single drop of fuel. And he's some music promoter or something.
But that's big money.
Yes, I mean, that's not a little cash heist.
Yeah, so if you look at Jackie Salibi, for example, he went to prison for 115,000 rand.
It's nothing.
It's nothing. You know, if you look at what's going on with state capture and the Guptas, we're talking billions.
Yeah.
Billions.
Are they the arch criminals? Really?
Well, I think it certainly looks that way. You know, from the Gupta leaks and all of that. I mean, I think that they've taken state capture to like a whole other level.
That was a good outfit until they were rumbled at Watercliffe Air Force Base at the wedding.
Yeah. I think
they were really running a good show.
They really were running a good show. It was slick and it was...
Because we hadn't heard the names of the Guptas.
Oh, we'd heard the names. You know, like we'd like heard about them through...
Most of us in the public had.
And, you know, all of that. So that's the thing also, is that often people will hear the stories on the news, but they won't see the bigger picture. So you'll hear bits and pieces of all of these different people and their connections. But when you put it all together and you look at all of the different connections and that entire web laid bare, that's when it's most frightening, to see how everyone's connected to everyone else.
Do you have a room at home with like a big board and then you have those pieces of string and you connect the different people and you
get
photographs?
Of course
I
do.
I can imagine you doing that. I really could. It would be such a great movie. You know, Mandy Wiener running around in front of this board, putting up pictures and drawing like floor plans of Radovan Krech's house and...
That sounds very sexy.
It is, right?
I wish my house looked like that.
I'm sure that one day you're going to have this room. Listen, when you meet these guys and you hear their stories, because we could talk about the details of the book in a second. When you hear their stories, are there any of them that do put you in a position where you're not easy?
Sure. You know, I mean, I think that...
Do you ever feel unsafe?
Yeah, I try hard not to like make too much, too many judgments about it. But certainly there are times where you think, oh, you know, shouldn't have come on my own. Should have brought somebody with me. Because I generally go on my own. And often it's beforehand. But I find these guys not quite as dangerous as... Because they are more... I suppose it's more of a euphemism, really. Like, they're not the trigger men, often.
Yeah, so you almost... So, you can reason with them. You sit down, you have a coffee. But
many of them are very intelligent.
And they want to be seen to be quite genteel and, correct, you know, evolved. They want to be taken seriously. These are not the kind of guys who want to be seen as trigger-happy gangsters who are high on tick.
Yeah, exactly. So I generally feel more unsafe with people who I can't reason with, who are unstable, who are irrational.
And you've met a lot of those in your career
As a radio reporter, sure, I've often been in situations where I felt unsafe, and that's because you're dealing with more kind of violent criminals.
So you're saying almost give me a Radovan any day over a, like, 14-year-old who's high and jittery.
Yeah, definitely, because it's unpredictable.
Yeah.
You know, whereas in the greater scheme of things, somebody like one of these bigger players are more dangerous. But I suppose I feel more vulnerable around...
But do you think you almost have a bit of immunity too, because you are the conduit through which their story is going to be told? They almost have an interest in keeping you safe and making sure that you're treated well.
To an extent. You know, I never like to say that I'm protected by them, or that they... You know, I don't have a personal relationship with any of them. You know, I remain a journalist, but I am the conduit in many ways. And I don't think I've upset them in any way.
That's what's remarkable. I kind of wonder if you've ever got those calls from unknown numbers late at night and just been a little bit nervous about answering it.
Yeah, so I mean, this is a conversation that I've had a lot with other journalists recently as well, and generally we're quite uncomfortable about this idea that journalists are in some way endangered. Or that we get death threats. I mean, journalists do get death threats, but also the kind of guy who's going to phone you late at night and spook you or send you a badly worded, misspelt SMS, it's not the guy who's going to take you out. You're not going to see it coming if it does happen. Did you hear the story, to digress, but this mad story about this Russian journalist who everyone thought was dead, and then he showed up at the press conference yesterday.
So he's alive?
Yes!
What?
Did you not know this? No, tell me the story.
All right, okay. No, get back to the book in a second. Tell us.
No, I mean, last I checked, when was it when I first saw this story? So it was a day ago.
He's a critic of the Kremlin and Putin. And he was taken out in Kiev.
Yes.
And there was, like, big headlines. Everyone thought Putin was behind it and that this guy had been killed because he was a critic of the Kremlin. And then they had a big press conference yesterday about his murder. And he showed up at the press conference.
Drama.
Such drama. Even his wife didn't know. And they got a tip-off that he was going to be killed. So they staged the whole thing to arrest the people. Dude, this is like James Bond stuff. This is epic.
Yeah.
And he was there.
What a
at
story.
At the press conference. Yeah, sorry, I completely digressed. So I got so excited about this.
No, but that is exciting.
Yeah, that is. That's a storyline. That's a script.
Yeah, but that's the truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
Like, you could never make the stuff up. People wouldn't believe you.
Well, even our stories, though. I mean, if you think about the president and the Guptas, and this is a movie waiting to be made.
Yeah, I've actually been chatting to some helping some movie producers with some script lines for other things based in South Africa, and we have this conversation with them, like
choose.
There's
a smorgasbord.
Well, then this happened in this one, and then I mean, you could put this plot line in, but people wouldn't believe it. It's crazy.
So crazy. Now that the former president Jacob Zuma is gone, a lot of these things are starting to become detached. A lot of the relationships are breaking down. A lot of the people who were in positions of power have lost their influence and their power. And when those things happen, it creates vacuums. Mm. And then you end up with a lot of people spilling the beans. Because now they realize that their only way to keep themselves safe sometimes is to spill the beans on someone else. Are you discovering that it's now easy to crack open places that you couldn't get into before?
Not like remarkably so. I think that they did. I think you are going to see a lot of people going to like the prosecuting authority to try and get deals. Particularly as the Gupta leaks investigation, the whole state capture thing happens, I think we're going to see a lot of people scrambling to save themselves.
But Sean Abrams is still in charge there, and the NPA doesn't seem to be prosecuting anyone.
Yeah. So
am I being unfair?
No, I mean, look, this court judgment this week on the Guptas is an absolute disaster. You know, it's
really... It makes them look even more incompetent.
And there's a couple of issues around it that explains it. So I firmly believe that what we're seeing today is the fruits of what's happened over the past decade of expertise fleeing the state and going into the private sector because of this evisceration. So a lot of the really, really good prosecutors have left... the NPA, and they want to work for auditing firms.
And if you're a bad guy, you can now hire them to consult you on how to avoid prosecution.
And then Justice Malala made a really good point as well, saying that the NPA is also not prosecution fit. They haven't prosecuted corruption in such a long time that they don't even remember how to do it, which to an extent is true. So that's a real issue. Look, I'm not entirely bleak and skeptical about the future around the criminal justice system. Certainly, we are seeing the right appointments being made at the police, and we've seen Tom Moyani out at SARS and Arthur Fraser out at State Security. The Sean Abrahams issue is a problem because it affects public confidence in the NPA. The issue is that there's a constitutional court judgment that we're waiting for. So he can't go anywhere. But the longer that he remains at the NPA, the longer the public perception of the NPA will be impacted.
As a journalist, how often do you discover in hindsight that certain people have lied to you about the facts? Because I would imagine that that happens quite a lot.
Yeah, all the time.
So then... over the years, are you able to see lies coming from a mile away?
Or Mandy's notes will often say, Radovan told me X, Y, arrow, bullshit.
Well, I mean, you're not dealing with the most honest people in the world, so I'm sure every now and again they'll tell you something because, you know, they're trying to throw you off the scent or...
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, I'm not naive about it.
Yeah.
So it's hard because even in the book, I try and give different versions given by different people of the same event. Somebody has to be lying.
Mm.
Not everyone's telling the truth. If people have got conflicting stories, somebody is lying. That's just the way it's going to work. And you know, often because I cover the story for so long, I've got institutional memory about it. So somebody could tell me something outside a court case, and then a few years later tell me something different, and I'll be like, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1 + 1 doesn't equal 14.
Exactly. A lot of the book has to do with Radovan Krejcer, and a lot of it is his story and the story of his prosecution. And I mean, there are amazing things in here about the stuff that he, even in prison, is getting up to. When you put this together, how do you even... Do you also have mind maps all over the place to kind of make sense of this? Like you put together the organogram of the different criminals, and you almost become... a kind of a prosecutor without judging when you put these things together too. I'm curious about the process.
So the process, it took me a lot longer than I thought it would, just because when you start scratching, you get further and further, and you have to interview this person and then that person.
Yeah.
But the last month before the book went to print was an absolute nightmare, because then that one wanted to speak, and then that one wanted to speak. The last third of the book was written in the 3 weeks before we went to print, because suddenly everybody wanted to give interviews, so it was a mad scramble. A lot of it lives in my head, actually, because I've covered it for so long, I understand it, and it's such a complex story. Even trying to draw an organogram was so difficult, because I understand it in my head, but putting it onto paper is really, really hard. And the book was way too long, so I had to cut it down a lot and simplify it for people. Because for me, the detail is important, but it might not be so important for you.
Yeah, that must have been difficult to do, because you're also leaving out stuff there that you've spent a lot of time on.
Yeah.
And
I cut whole chapters.
Jeez.
Because I'd written, and I just thought this book is going to be way too long. And that doesn't necessarily add to this narrative. So I literally had to cut out entire chapters.
This Paul O'Sullivan, I mean, he's an interesting man because he's been a part of the national conversation for the longest time. I do not understand him. I don't get his motivation. I don't know what... I'm not saying he's good or bad or anything else. I just don't understand the guy. He seems to put himself in the way of danger all the time. He's got this dogged... If he was working for the state, I'd get it.
Paul's a very complex character, and I've spent a long time working with him and looking at stories that he's involved in, and I still don't entirely understand him. So, on Paul's version, he does it purely out of a pursuit of justice.
Mm.
And he's self-funded, and...
He's like Javert from Les Miserables.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of got this hell-bent desire to fix things that are wrong.
But he has many critics, and there are lots of questions around what he does. You know, many people question his funding. You know, for example, I mean, something that he's not happy about me talking about, that he's taken issue with, is this issue of Zunaid Moti, where he, the very well-known businessman in Joburg, where he initially investigated Moti and was against him and called him a gangster, although he says he didn't call him a gangster, and then now he's working as a consultant to Zunaid Moti. And he's recommended to Lord Peter Hain that he work for him too. So there's those kind of incidents that raise questions. There's lots of questions around his involvement with IPED. You know, and then he says that the only reason that he's being targeted is because he's going after corrupt cops. So Pakhlane, as an example, has been behind O'Sullivan's arrest because O'Sullivan's going after him. So Paul O'Sullivan does really important work, and he's often a critical element of getting many witnesses to speak and then handing them over to the prosecuting authorities. But with that comes the risk of tainting a case. You know, some people have called him the docket killer because he'll go in and be too involved, and there'll be a feeling that he'll taint the case because, as a private citizen, he's involved. But he's very popular in the public, and that's because, you know, he has earned himself a reputation as a cop hunter.
Yeah.
He has brought down national police commissioners, and that has to be commended, although his methods are often questionable.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's lots of skullduggery and danger and deceit and stuff that goes on behind the scenes in order to make some of this come to light that we don't want to know. You don't go into the kitchen to see how they make sausages.
Yeah, and I'm sure in fighting for justice, as he states, that doesn't necessarily mean that he's not breaking any of the rules in getting to that final
case. So what he does is he doesn't break the rules. He doesn't break the law. He pushes them as far as possible. And you know, he admits this, like he'll send emails and like he's been taken to court for threatening emails and you know, by lawyers and things like that. So he's very careful not to break the law, but his methods are definitely very abrasive. And
but you're saying he's a good ingredient. I mean, there are ingredients that make this book and the stories in South Africa interesting, and we need people on various platforms,
Look,
levels,
he's
places.
He's relentless.
Yeah.
So, and we need people like that because he nips at the investigating officer
constantly. And he's not
constantly.
Afraid.
He's not afraid of anything. And we need people like that who aren't afraid of anything. I mean, there were attempts on his life.
Mm.
You know, there are people, Kreacher and several other people are on trial for plotting to kill him.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to be fearless to do that.
What about Richard Ndluli? Where is he at the moment? He's swanning around.
Yeah, so he got an early retirement package. He landed up getting 12 million rand, including a performance bonus, while he was on suspension for 8 years as head of crime intelligence in the country. So he's left the police now. I'm not sure how involved he still is. While he was on suspension, there were many people saying that he was still running crime intelligence. Richard Ndluli became like this bogeyman in South Africa, where he almost personified all that was evil about the police and the capture of the criminal justice system. And that's because he appeared to have the protection of the president. he had the highest political protection. And many people believe that he knows where the bodies are buried, and he's got dirt on everyone, which is why he was protected to the extent that he was. And that's because he had a very powerful position. He was the guy who was in charge of all of the clandestine operations, so he could listen to anybody's phone.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of VIP protection, which meant that he knew where all the cabinet ministers were and what they were doing. And he had huge resources at his disposal.
And he could, you could bump into him at the shops today.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's probably in Boxburg.
Yeah, he's leading a normal life.
Well, as far as we know.
Yeah. And then, you know, there's so many other names in here, but I did want to get O'Sullivan and Lully out of the way, because they are kind of the larger-than-life characters, with the exception of Croce, in the story to a very big degree. Do you still speak to and interact with Agliotti?
Yeah, so he, you see him around town sometimes. He spends a lot of time in Mauritius.
No, like you bump into him and he's buying a loaf of bread. You see him around town.
No, you do. Like,
what's it meant? What's happening?
Love you, my baby.
Oh, love you. How's the new book coming along, eh?
So, yeah, I mean, he's managed to completely evade justice. You know, there was always the possibility that he could be prosecuted for the whole Celebi thing, because he never got indemnity. He never got his 204 deal.
Mm.
So he could have been prosecuted, but there's just never the political will to do it. So he's still businessing.
Okay, is that political will there to sort out some of this now? Because you've said there have been a couple of appointments that have been made in the new administration. And obviously they've just got started, so we've got to give them a little bit of time. It's only a few months for the new president and a new cabinet. There's new police minister. How much of a difference does all that stuff make?
I think that the appointments that have been made at the police are really good. So Godfrey Lobbia, who's just been appointed as the head of the Hawks, I interviewed him. We had fruit salad last year when I was...
Is that a code for something? We had fruit salad? Wow. What ammunition is that he passed you under the table? Yeah?
And, I mean, he's quite a kind of vanilla guy, actually, because he's such a stickler for the rules. So he's fastidious about legislation.
You need those kind of people.
Totally. Yeah. And so he's an advocate. He's got a doctorate. His doctoral thesis was on understanding organized crime.
So he
literally wrote the textbook on organized crime.
Sure.
But not only that, he's also a career police officer. So he grew up in rural Limpopo, in Queen Mujaji area. And he never really wanted to be a police officer. He wanted to be an engineer. But he didn't have many options, so he ended up going to the police academy. And one of his first jobs was, I mean, he was the guy who was in the office when the detectives used to come in and hand in their case dockets, mm-hmm. and he'd have to take the statements and file them. So he used to sit there and read all the different statements and work out which detectives were good and who got people to talk, and he used to just read case dockets. And then he became a commercial crimes detective, and then he started doing more like fraud investigations. So he's gotten the entire way up the ladder. And so he's very, very experienced, and he's a stickler, as I say, for the rules.
So he's the head of?
The Hawks. Now, which is, I mean... Perfect. And, you know, he was pushed out by Ria Piecha a few years ago unlawfully. He went to court and challenged that decision. And it was because he was seen as the guy who was driving the case against Richard Mdluli. He was seen as not being politically in the right camp. So he's being brought back now. Peter Jacobs is also a career cop with experience in the intelligence world. From all accounts, from people I've spoken to at intelligence, they seem to say that he's doing good things. But crucially, what we have at the moment, for the first time in years, is a permanent national police commissioner, a permanent head of crime intelligence, and a permanent head of the Hawks.
And a minister in Bekikele, who seems to make the right sounds.
Yeah, well, what can you tell us about the new minister?
Well, people also tend to forget that he was removed as National Police Commissioner because of his dodgy deal.
Rental deals on buildings.
On the the Ministat building in, mm-hmm. in Pretoria with Rushabangu. So there was a public protector's report in by Thuli Madonsela, no less, saying that there were issues around this. But yet we've forgiven him and he's come back as police minister. But he's a popular appointment because he makes the right
he's
noises.
He's like a man of action as well. I saw them
The 10111 thing. Did you see that?
Yeah. Where he was phoning people.
People were phoning 10111 and he was answering.
And he was answering, yeah.
Hello, this is Becky.
I mean, if you're phoning 10111 and you have an emergency, you really want somebody to deal with your emergency and then not have Becky Kele saying...
Stomach interested.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he's doing things.
Okay, so these are permanent appointments because we did have acting this and acting that for God knows how long. And the cost of all those people was enormous.
And also, the problem is that you've got this... factory line of national commissioners, and they all come in and they want their own people and they want to move things around, and then they want to move this person they want to disband the specialist units, and then no, they want to put the specialist units together again and in the different systems, and it's very hard, you know, to know what the hell's going on. So I think it's good that there is a permanent commissioner now and that he's a career cop and that there can be some stability. And crime intelligence is crucial. So if you look at all the cash and transit heists that are going on at the moment.
Big news.
It's big news. So a lot of that comes down to intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And intelligence has been so busy doing intelligence on each other.
Are you talking about the NIA now?
No, I'm talking about still crime intelligence.
Okay.
And NIA.
Because that NIA...
Well, it's called Secret Service.
Have you seen that facility?
State Security Agency.
Have you been to that facility out there near Rietvlei?
No.
It's enormous. You go and look at the Google Earth. You just go and check out how huge that campus is. These satellite dishes all over the place. It's like 20 buildings. It's a monster. And this was all expanded hugely under Jacob Zuma because he was paranoid, obviously, about, you know, who was talking about him and what people knew.
And also,
and
he comes
didn't.
From a security background. Yes. You know, he was in charge of intelligence.
So God knows, they've got everything on Mabali. I mean...
Oh,
everything.
Damn it. Okay, you know what? It's time for me to leave now. I just remember that thing I've got to do.
But that's that crime intelligence stuff, that's where they get the info to do the cash heists.
So a lot of the crime intelligence officers are involved.
Yes.
In the cash heisting. Mm-hmm. And the evidence bears this out. You know, I'm not just saying it. It's because, you know, invariably when they make arrests, there's police officers involved. There's often security expert company
there's
employees.
There's military weapons sometimes.
So just look at the example of Captain KGB. Maurice Shabalala, mm-hmm. and that story where you've got a guy who was a crime intelligence officer who was convicted of armed robbery for being involved in cash heist and then went back to crime intelligence to go be a crime intelligence agent again and then was rearrested after he was allegedly involved in that massive Tambo heist a year or two ago. So, I mean, that is very concerning. In Parliament this week, the minister said that, or the commissioner, I forget, said that there are 27 crime intelligence officers with criminal records, which is a real worry. You know, so most of them are traffic offences.
Sure.
I mean, happens to the best of us.
No, I haven't got mine. When do those things expire?
I don't know if they do. Sorry.
Damn it.
It's never really got in my way, but I sort of think about it every now and then.
Except if you want to apply for a visa in Australia, maybe.
No, I don't need to go to Australia. Everywhere else I can go to, so obviously Australia. Who cares?
So it's worrying that so many of our intelligence agents have got criminal records.
Yeah. I'm also... What is it like to be in the police right now? Because it seems like it's been in the most horrible disarray for the longest time. And you deal with a lot of these guys, like the important officers at the top and the ordinary cops at the bottom who do the investigations and, you know, are trying their best. There are a lot of good cops in this
country. The important point to make is that there are a lot of excellent police officers and prosecutors.
They really are good
people.
Who
are committed and passionate, and they try not to get disillusioned
by the
politics at the top.
They have no resources very often. They're understaffed. They, at the bottom of the chain, they don't get very much in the way of support.
Yeah, so a lot of them are very disillusioned by all of that, and they've got to just keep plodding on. I think the thing that probably frustrates them more than anything else from the ones I've spoken to is the fact that they kill themselves and put themselves in massive danger to arrest people, and then they see them being released on bail or falling through the cracks of the justice system. And that's the thing that affects them most, where they'll stay up... nights in a row, bringing people to bring them in and locking them up, and then they get let free again. Having said that, though, there have been some really big convictions lately, which is important to mention.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that shows that the criminal justice system does work.
And it's starting to get
We're
its,
not in some kind of dystopian wasteland where there's no rule of law. And people are quite dramatic about this. They're like, is the criminal justice system failing?
People like a bit of drama, though.
Yeah. So we still live in a functional democracy. People are still convicted of crimes. There's still law and order. You know, just Arno Lemoore, who was the Western Cape Police Commissioner, was convicted of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the Sandiswe Mantswe case where there was a conviction. Yes. Van Bredaar, he was convicted. So, you know, we can't be entirely disillusioned with what's going
what's
on.
What's the most dangerous city in South Africa? Is it Cape Town? Is it Joburg? Durban?
I think according to the crime statistics, it's... I think it's Cape Town.
Get murdered more easily. But from an organized crime point of view, Joburg?
So look, if you look at the organized crime issue, it's not just people like Croatia. You know, there's a lot going on. There's lots of different underworlds
there's
that don't get a lot of attention. So illegal tobacco is
there's
enormous.
There's prostitution, there's drugs.
Abalone is a huge thing.
PE.
So like abalone in PE is massive. The drug trade is enormous still. Like coming in at the PE and Durban harbours. Illegal tobacco is very big. There is human trafficking. You know, there's lots of the taxi industry is and the violence associated with that at the moment is enormous. So when we talk about the underworld and organized crime, and we look at people like the Craters and you know, Modak and all of that in Cape Town, that's just where the media spotlight shines.
Right.
There's lots of places where the media spotlight does not shine that we just don't know about. You know, the triads, we know nothing about.
The Russians.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the country that we just don't know about. And I don't even know if the intelligence structures know that much about them. In fact, Prince Mokotedi is the head of the Hawks in Gauteng at the moment.
You actually did something interesting. Right at the end of your book, you have an interview with him. And he actually said to you, the first person who's asked me.
Yeah.
Actually come to me and ask me what the hell's going on.
Yeah, and he said to me that they've had meetings with representatives from other countries where these people have said to him, these are our known criminals that are in South Africa at the moment, and they're not even on the radar of the South African police. They don't even know about them. Mm. So there's all of these fugitives that are here that are seeking refuge in South Africa, and we just don't even know about them.
It's easy to get in and out of this country, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you want to, if you know the right people. I mean, look at Gavrich. This is the story of Dobrosov Gavrich, who went by the name of Sasha, who lived in the country. He was able to get gun licenses and car licenses and run businesses and register businesses. And he lived here, and the entire time we didn't know that he was the Arkan Slayer. He was the assassin in Serbia that had taken out a warlord.
Sia, you're nervous.
His heart actually stopped beating for a bit.
I just am giving up. I'm going home. I'm shutting the blinds, locking the door, and just will look through.
So this is the exact opposite
the
effect of what I wanted when I wrote the book.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't want people to freak out like this and to despair.
But I already told you when I bumped into you at the airport not so long ago, I said, your books ruined my life. I can't tear myself away from them because they're fascinating and intriguing. And really, you are the best at this, Mandy, by a New York mile. But... my God, it makes you scared.
Mm. But I want the opposite effect.
What did you
hope? So I want people to read the book, and I want them to be aware so that the cycle does not repeat itself again. Because what happened with Jackie Salivi and Glenn Agliotti 10 years ago, we should have known that it would happen again. And we've allowed it to happen again and again on a much grander scale. I mean, Salivi was early onset state capture, where we had the National Police Commissioner captured.
That's
and we should have woken up then and gone... we can't let this happen. And to the credit of civil society, in every single incident that's happened with Richard Mdluli, you know, with Burning and Tlameza, it's always been civil society that has stepped in and gone to court. So KSAC, Freedom Under Law, all of these organizations that have brought court applications to stop them. And we need to be active citizens.
So, you
know, we need to support these civic rights organizations to ensure that the cycle does not repeat itself. And we can't be naive about it. And also, we need to recommit to the criminal justice system. So, if you're studying law, you've got to decide, do I want to open my own legal practice, or do I want to go be a state prosecutor? You know, if I am a forensic expert, do I want to go work for a KPMG or an EY or PwC, or do I actually want to go and work for the police and do forensics and go and be a hawk?
Yeah, they need expertise desperately.
Absolutely, because they don't have them, and they need. And that's how you deal with corruption. It's not about the money; it's about the passion for the job and for the rule of law.
Yeah, they're rare creatures, though, those ones who like to prosecute, who like to find out what the real truth is, who like to go after these guys.
And you have to have a sense of justice.
Yeah, big time. All right, well, the book is full of new revelations about high-profile unsolved hits, the complicity between criminals and the police, a window into the current turf war playing out in Cape Town, we didn't even touch on that, through the eyes of the protagonists and the investigators, and also a look at police corruption at all levels and unpacking the relationship between organized crime and the police. And that's just scratching the surface. You need to get Mandy Wiener's new book. It is called A Ministry of Crime, The Underworld Explored. Get it at good bookstores today. And listen, congratulations to you. Killing Kebble, what, over 80,000 copies sold?
A little bit more. But look, it's no...
Are we up to 100?
No, yeah, we're over 100, but...
J.K. Rowling
but
money?
No, yet? Look, Jacques Poe has blown me out of the water a little bit.
Yeah, but you got three books. He's got the one.
Four. No, he's got more than one. He's got like...
No one cared about
many.
The other ones.
Okay.
You're like Jacques. So you got the...
He only exposed like Flakplas and the Death Squad.
No. Yeah. You were shortlisted for the Alan Paton Sunday Times Literary Awards book for Killing Kebble, and then you were chosen as Book of the Year in a number of different publications and by a number of different people. You continue to break all the records, so congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. It's always great to come in and chat to you.
Listen, you're the person who knows everybody who knows everybody. Mm. Can't do without you.
I actually get, you know, sometimes I like to get a little bit dramatic, and I say, I wish I knew people who know people. Mm. I feel like after today, I can phone Mandy and say, so listen,
actually,
I need somebody to have their knees like...
Oh, yeah, because I'm the person you phone.
Like, can you recommend someone that I could call?
And you'll be like...
I'm just in a meeting with someone. I'll call you back.
And then
doesn't.
How many knees?
Just the one. Let's just break the one knee for now.
Yeah, my buddy's going to be phoning you saying, the guy number 26 down in my complex looks very suspicious. Do you get calls like that from people? Do you get people? You said in the book, actually, you said thank you to everybody who gives you tips. And look, a lot of these people are morons. They're giving you tips that... Like the granny in number 13 has a pair of binoculars and she's watching me when I get changed. You don't need to know that shit.
No, I don't need to know that. Thanks. But no, not so much. Yeah, I get a lot of tip-offs, but some of them, like people also have this warped understanding of what's newsworthy and what isn't, unfortunately. So it might be really important and newsworthy to you, but to the greater public, not so much.
Yeah.
But also, you know, we don't get half the stories if it's not for whistleblowers and people wanting to speak out. So it's so important.
Well, go and read the book. You will not want to put it down. Ministry of Crime. Mandy Wiener, thank you very much.
This is CliffCentral.com.